Hi, this is Candy Minx, your humble agent in Chicago. With screw the tea, I'm drinking wine.
Excellent, because I do have a wee shot of scotch. This okay. is Eugene Napick, your agent in Toronto.
Okay, good. How's your day? How's your week going?
It's going pretty good. I went out mushroom hunting yesterday, foraging with our old friend, our mutual friend, Hobie.
Good. How wonderful.
It was
How was the weather? How was the weather? How were the mushrooms?
Well, the weather, we had some showers while we were out, but it wasn't serious and it was a warm day. It turned out to be actually a delightful morning. Hobie had never gone foraging for mushrooms before.
Oh, okay.
And he's very much a Renaissance guy. You know, he does a lot of different things. Really interesting fellow.
He really is. He was like that back in the day when I first knew him, too. He was always like that.
So we went out and visited a couple of different forests. And while we didn't come home with baskets of mushrooms, we certainly did get plenty for both of us to eat. And we found some interesting mushrooms as well. We found a small chicken of the woods, which is always a treat. It's rare to find a small one, though. Usually when you find a chicken of the woods, it's this enormous set of bright orange shelves.
Taking over a trunk or something, right?
That's right, on a stump. Yeah. And they're super tasty, delicious. This was just a very small one. And as well, we found some lobster mushrooms. Lobster mushrooms you may have seen available commercially. They're collected out west, typically, in BC and California, and sold commercially. And they're the product of a mushroom attack when a certain kind of cup fungus, a hypomyces, attacks a host mushroom. And it's a really curious thing that happens because there's two possible host mushrooms that are very similar. One is a lactarius or a milk cap, and the other one is a kind of a russula mushroom. Very similar mushrooms, and both of those mushrooms are edible but not palatable.
Okay, in other words,
you would just go, yuck, I'm not eating this.
Right.
It's bitter and hot and nasty. But when this cup fungus comes along and attacks the host mushroom, it causes it to contort. And it causes it to change color to the color of a cooked lobster shell. You know, that red-orange color?
I do. Yes,
and
I do.
It makes it into a choice edible, a super tasty mushroom. So we found some of those. And we also found some pear-shaped puffballs, which are a small variety of puffball. You're probably used to seeing those large soccer ball-sized giant puffballs. These are small ones that grow on wood. And they're also a nice, delicate mushroom. So we got a good variety. We enjoyed walking around in the woods and chit-chatting about all kinds of things. So it was
great. You know,
how's your week been?
You know, every mushroom is good once.
Well, that's true. And, and what we like to say is there are old foragers and there are bold foragers.
There you go.
There are no old, bold foragers.
No. mine was good. I had to do an emergency run out. I took my keys home from work by accident, and we just had to run out and do it. So kind of frazzled time period in the last hour, you know, kind of going to do that. Week's been good. I had a terrible cold, so I felt like I kind of missed the ball a lot last time on the podcast. As soon as we finished last week, I just felt, oh my God, my cold. I didn't realize I was getting a cold. And so I'm going to try not to sneeze and cough, but I'm doing much better right now. And I had to work every day because people were sick at work. I was covering shifts or they were already booked off for holidays. So
there must be a cold going around your workplace then.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's my fault.
So was there something you wanted to add to what we were talking about last week?
Yeah, there was actually, because the reason I started thinking about it was because I had screwed up the RCMP story. I thought it was about the protesters. So I went and did a little looking around, and I noticed that Cameron Ortiz is arrested for possibly providing information to a company called Phantom Serve Communications. And that company, based in BC, of all things, is providing encrypted communication devices to individual criminals, to international criminals. I thought that was pretty interesting. And Vice, I read Vice and CBC and a few other reports, and apparently it sounds like they've got something. They found when they checked out Phantom Serve, they found emails from Cameron Ortiz saying, "You don't know me. I have information that I am confident you will find very valuable. Plus, with a promise to provide intel about your associates and individuals using their network internationality." So I'm trying to figure out what the heck was he into? Why was he doing this? There's a rumor that he was in debt, and it just seems like really kind of rough. And, you know, when it goes to a criminal and involved with criminals, it's got to be money.
Well, I think so.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I think that I wanted to say that there's a thing that's called MICE. Which, of course, not the mice in your coat, but MICE, money, ideology, compromise, and ego. Those are the reasons why people might become a spy and why they might also become a counter-spy. So for me, it sounds like...
We were talking about the Americans last week.
Right.
And their think ideology. All of those motives are covered in that show.
Right, but particularly the KGB or ideology. And I think the Americans are too, at least in that era in the 80s. It was definitely ideology based. And that's actually part of the entertainment of the show, I think, is when they're completely repulsed by Christianity and belief systems and materialism. It's kind of, that's actually kind of the humor in the show is, you know, their ideology is so different than American ideology. The other thing was, you're ahead of me, quite ahead of me on the Americans.
Yeah.
Because I was first watching it, nagged you into watching it, and then, of course, when we were at your place, Stag started watching it. Now he's interested, so I've been going through the whole first two seasons with him. We're almost at the end of the second season, and at one point during it, I recall thinking to him, and I'm telling Stag, like, I am obsessed with how it's a metaphor for making films and making actors and actors doing their parts, because these guys are so good at makeup and art and you're creating all these identities. And lo and behold, in one of the episodes in this season, they have the film, The French Lieutenant's Woman. And that film is based on a John Fowles book where he gets it turned into a movie, and Harold Pinter makes it into a movie because the novel has five endings. And these endings have always been kind of like metafiction and very confusing. Some people hate the novel for that. Some people loved it. And how are they going to have five endings in the movie? What they decided to do was to create characters who are playing the actors who are going to make the movie The French Lieutenant's Woman. And it shows up twice in the Americans in one episode. And I thought that was pretty cool because it did tell me that the producers and the writers of the show must have the same sensation of a metaphor for acting as I do watching the show. Where are you guys in it?
We're on season 6 right now, and there's a major twist. It's the final season, and there's a serious twist. I'm not going to talk to you about it until you catch up.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we've been discussing this television show. It's been a major topic of conversation for us so far in the podcast, and it occurred to me that television is something which has changed significantly over the years since it's been released from the tyranny of a handful of network executives. And I wonder, do you think that television potentially is becoming the 21st century art?
Well, someone told me at a cocktail party that TV is a novel and movies are short stories. And I thought that was a good analogy. I guess it is the art form. It certainly is right now. It's the one that everyone is obsessed with, and it's available to so many people. And even if you don't watch the shows when they come out, they have a life of their own. You know, over the years, people are sharing DVDs or finally getting it. It's getting on Netflix. So it's pretty amazing. We are able to know characters almost as well as we know people in our lives, maybe better. Actually, yes, probably better.
Absolutely. I think that the best example of a TV show being like a novel, or maybe the breakthrough example, would be The Wire. because that was a show which in which the entire group of seasons, the whole story arc was preconceived, and it was an opportunity to get to know the characters in depth, and at the same time having sections by season in which different themes were explored. So very much, I think that was a breakthrough in novel-like television. And in my eyes, that could only have existed really with The Sopranos,
right?
Which was maybe less like a novel, but is an example of following a set of characters who you come to really like, who are really unsavory characters.
Right.
I mean, they're gangsters, and you know, just when you think they're really good guys, they go out and kill people. Right. And you see that in The Wire as well, where, you know, in the first season, there's not a lot of difference between the police and the drug dealers, and you kind of get to like all of them equally well.
It's true. Also, I think you can really predict if someone said, okay, Tony Soprano is going to be in this situation, what do you think he's going to do? Almost all of us would be able to come up with something that he would do. We know him so well. The thing that's weird about TV is that there's huge committees writing these TV shows. It's kind of like the stamina that happened in the porn industry, where it used to be that you were dependent on someone having an erection. Once Viagra got involved, women were getting exhausted in these porn films because there was no, there was no end to it. And when you've got a committee writing a TV show, there's no end to, is it possible to jump the shark? I mean, TV shows start out jumping the shark. They're so over the top with, they've got a realism, but then they also have this decadence that they can play out. How many ways can Walter White get out of trouble? You know, how many ways can Tony Soprano kill somebody or have his mistress or outwit his wife, etc.? I mean, it's not just one person writing it, or even four people. It's not like the Dick Van Dyke Show where they're sitting in a room writing a thing. They've got 20 people writing these characters and these storylines, and they're mapping them out.
And you know what else is really different is we're starting to see, and you could see some of that with The Wire, but you see it in The Americans as well, in which many of them are directed by John Dahl, who's one of my favorite movie directors.
Me too, me too.
You know, Red Rock West and Kill Me Again, among other films.
Right.
Really fantastic film director working now in television. And I think we're seeing more and more of that as well.
And they're able to be highly experimental. You know, there's some of the greatest cinematography is happening in these TV shows, and some of the greatest dialogue. I mean, that you're not going to be able to have time to explore discussions about all the red flag topics in our culture, racism, sexism. I mean, they are totally exploring them in these TV shows in a way that we haven't. So. Yeah, that we have not seen before.
Interestingly, though, I don't think that diminishes film. I think film is just becoming something a little bit different.
I agree. I mean, part of the reason we see so many of the comic book and big action is just because that's something that can be done on film, but and to get people into the seats. But I think it's going to keep on going. I do. I don't think it's going to end. You know, the death of movies. Not yet.
Oh, no, they've been trying to kill off painting, too, for
right.
years. My whole painting career, people have been telling me painting is dead.
Right.
That makes me want to do it even more.
Exactly.
So I'd like to change the subject completely for a moment, if I could. Another of my friends has been indoctrinated into a cult.
Okay.
The cult following a guru named Instant Pot.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
and
that's pretty powerful.
I feel like John Henry, trying to trying to race the steam drill through the mountain. You know, I think we need to hold an intervention here, and we need to just get everybody a cast iron pan.
And what happens with the cast iron pan?
Well, I mean, you can cook anything you want with a cast iron pan.
That's true.
And the beauty of it is you're not in a rush. I'm just getting really tired of everybody wanting to rush to get something made. Oh, you can get you can make this stew in I don't know how many minutes.
Oh my God, you know what? I'm so confused. I thought you meant Instant Pot like edibles. I thought it was some
I was talking about a kitchen appliance.
Okay. Oh, Instant Pot. Right. Instant Pot. I don't know why everything has to be so fast either. I mean, go to a restaurant or something and go to get food takeout if it has to be that fast, because I'm not sure it's that much better at home if you're making it. But yeah, why does everything have to be so fast? I think we're just tired. People are exhausted and they want to cook quickly so they can go back to their TV shows.
Well, yeah, and plus there's some heavy-duty marketing around it. But for me, I'll take the cast iron pan any day. And, you know, I learned to cook in, you know, I love to cook, right?
I do.
And I learned to cook in two sources. One, my mom.
Yeah. Because
she made all the old Polish food and that kind of stuff, and I learned how to cook all of that stuff.
Right.
But also, from television, I learned to cook from an old TV show. Do you remember that British guy who lived on a boat?
Oh, Graham Carr?
No. James Barber? Is that his name?
Oh, James Barber, sure.
Yeah, he had a show called The Fry Pan Man, in which he used a cast iron pan and made these one pan dishes on his boat, because he just had a hot plate on the boat. And then he graduated up to, I think, a higher budget show called The Urban Peasant. It was very similar, I think, in terms of approach. But I watched those as a little tot, and I learned to make all kinds of things in my cast iron pan. And so today, my kitchen has a few cast iron pans. It has one nonstick pan for, you know, omelets.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a microwave. Never had a microwave. Do you have a microwave in your place?
I would never have a microwave.
Yeah, never occurred to me to have one.
No, I'm actually dead against them. I actually see them as like chemtrails.
And it very well might be. You know, my brother makes instant coffee by heating up water in a microwave.
There's something
and then adding a spoon of instant coffee. That's the fastest possible.
That's even worse. That's so ridiculous. Instant coffee in a microwave. I mean, how Jetson is that?
Well, exactly. And he claims to have actually cooked in his microwave. He makes vegetables and things like that. And he told me he's even cooked meat in his microwave. And I think that was sort of, maybe that was a 70s phenomenon or the 80s when microwaves were first coming out. And you know, they would get like Madame Benoit to talk about how you can make wonderful dishes in your microwave, even though everybody discovered pretty quick that they'd rather use their cast iron pan.
And I think there is some science that it damages vitamins in the food. There is some science for that.
Well, there you go. There was one when we moved into this house here on 27th Street. There was a microwave in the kitchen, and we don't have a lot of room in our kitchen. We figured we could use the shelf to put spices, so we threw out the microwave.
Totally. Yep. We had a microwave at one point that someone gave us, and I had to pass it back to them. It's not going to happen. Go ahead.
Maybe I'm a Luddite. Maybe I'm John Henry. But damn it, this is my intervention. I'm asking all my friends, enough with the Instant Pot.
Yeah, I don't have an Instant Pot. I do have a crock pot. And we have a rice maker. I think that's what's really for steak, to cook rice. And, looking out the back window in Vancouver, all the houses, when I see my neighbors all using rice cookers, I figure they must know something. So I got a small rice cooker for us. And that's pretty good. Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's wonderful because you don't have to baby it. And I, for some reason, I lost my knack for cooking rice. I started, it just wouldn't cook properly. So a rice cooker, perfect. But I use the crock pot here and there, but I cooked in a cast iron pan tonight, made steak. steak and some salad and potato salad. Nice. Easy peasy. Easy peasy. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what the hot pot is. I guess people like to try something new. They get bored. And it's fast.
My mom used to have the original version of the pressure cooker
right.
when I was a kid. And, you know, my mom was a great cook in some areas. But she had this idea about fresh vegetables. She was a very good
cook. Okay.
Like, she would put asparagus into a pressure cooker no. and she would cook the shit out of that yeah. asparagus until it was this jelly
right.
mass of space goo.
Right. Right?
And I would look at that as a kid and think, oh my God, humans can't eat this. Why right. why does this person want me to eat this stuff? And it wasn't until really later when I was like out on a date and we were in a restaurant and asparagus came with the dinner and it was lightly sauteed with garlic and butter.
Yummy.
And
it's like, yummy.
Oh.
I mean, you can
it's like
cook
a different beast.
You can cook asparagus with a blow dryer. I mean, it cooks so quickly, it's ridiculous, you know? You
exactly.
could probably put it on the radiator in the sun or something, and it would cook.
Yeah, I don't know what the deal was. My mom just wanted to make sure those vegetables were plenty dead. Before.
Yeah, my mother did the same thing for a while, until we were living in BC, and then she got into, you know, raw vegetables. But yeah, somehow in my family, there was a side of my family that just, yeah, actually had to just 10 times murder their vegetables. Ridiculous.
I also wanted to mention.
Sorry.
Bless you.
Thank you.
I also wanted to mention, you know, last week we were talking about some changes here in Toronto in the Queen West area. And we talked about that goth bar, the Sanctuary, and how when it became a Starbucks, it kind of signaled the beginning of the end for Queen West as it was.
Sure.
And I guess I heard some news this week that suggested to me that maybe we're at the tail end of that process now. And that is one of our favorite places from back in the day, La Hacienda, is closing down.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I am sorry to hear that. That was a great place. One of the few Mexican restaurants in Toronto, that's for sure.
Yes, and it was a neighborhood joint, and it wasn't very expensive, and it was funky.
Do you know why they're closing?
I don't know. I know they've been open for about 30 years. Ooh, and I know when they originally opened, the owners basically polled the neighborhood to see what kind of food they wanted. And
okay.
you know, what they got back was, you know, Mexican comfort food. So that's what they made.
That's incredible. But
I don't know. Maybe they're just tired, or maybe the rent has gone up. I really don't know. But I had some good times there.
Definitely. I can't believe it's been 30 years. That is also the place where we were with Gidget and she stabbed a cockroach and complained to the waitress. And the waitress said, I'm going to charge you more for that.
Absolutely. I think she actually said, I ought to charge you $10 more for that.
Right, right.
She knew how much that cockroach was worth.
That's right. And she was from the band Sucker Punch.
Yes, she's the bass player for Sucker Punch.
Yeah, I hope they're still playing music.
I remember we used to go see that band play. They were a really hot band.
I love them. I love them. Yeah, they were a great band. What else? Oh, we had two emails. One from David again, a recurring email, and he said that he remembered when the Clinton Tavern, because we were talking about Twin Peaks, and it reminded him that the Clinton Tavern had opened up the front room and decorated like the Laura Palmer room. They had put the black and white tiles, red curtains, and they had really capitalized on people being into Laura Palmer. It is no longer like that at all, but that was pretty cool that that happened.
I don't remember it as the Laura Palmer room, but I remember the bar. I remember going to see bands there.
There's still bands there.
Clinton and Bluer, I think
there's still bands there.
Oh, yeah? Or is it Clinton in College?
You know what? I guess it was Clinton in College. It's so weird because I actually thought that it was on Queen Street, the bar that was the Laura Palmer room. But maybe there were two places that set up a Twin Peaks theme. It's entirely possible. It's possible.
I have a strong memory of going to that bar many, many years ago to see a band called the Hopping Penguins, a ska band, who did this wonderfully raucous version of the old Hockey Night in Canada theme and just got everybody, you know, bopping along with it. It was really, really quite wonderful.
Very cool. Very cool. Very cool. Listen, I've got other things. Back to the spies theme, is that you asked me last week what I was reading, and I'm reading a couple of things. I've got a to be read pile. One of them is from a friend of mine who I do meditation with, and he Dr. Kenneth Addison, and he wrote a book called "We Hold These Truths to Be Self-Evident." An interdisciplinary analysis of the roots of racism and slavery in America. I started reading it about 10 days ago, and it's very dense and very inspiring, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I will give you more information about it. But one thing that was really cool was, one, that it's someone I know who wrote it, and two, I'm reading the preface, and I'm thinking, wow, this is so great, this preface. And at the end of it, it was written by Cornel West, who is a big deal for me anyway. The other thing I started reading, and right after you asked me what am I reading, was I'm reading Edward Snowden's book, you know, the guy who turned in the NSA.
Yes, I hadn't even realized he had a book.
I know. It actually may be sold out. The rumors were that it was selling out like crazy. So it's very good. I read one review where someone said they didn't like the fact that he went through his school years, that it was boring just like everybody else's. And the thing was, I actually really enjoyed it. I'm quite surprised. He's such a good storyteller, and he has really good information about the world of the CIA and his office. And in fact, it would be another good movie about him, because he's kind of reinforcing all the stereotypes of these crazy underground warehouses that he worked in. And his childhood was a little bit like mine, a military family, and parents divorced, and he didn't fit into school in a lot of ways, and he would also find ways to get out of schoolwork, which I remember doing that too. how can I get out of schoolwork? I am notoriously one of the worst students ever out there. But I wanted to read a couple of things from the book, if you don't mind. I've got a couple of the excerpts here.
Yes, go ahead.
So one is about contractors. With contractors, they say, the government can encourage competitive bidding to keep costs down and isn't on the book to pay pensions and benefits. But the real advantage for government officials is the conflict of interest inherent in the budgeting process itself. IC directors ask Congress for money to rent contract workers from private companies. Congress people approve that money, and then these IC directors and Congress people are rewarded after they retire from office by being given high-paying positions in consultancies with the very companies they've just enriched. From the vantage of the corporate boardroom, contracting functions as governmentally assisted corruption. It's America's most legal and convenient method of transferring public money to the private purse. So I thought that was very insightful, and he does talk an awful lot about that behind the scenes. He also says that the CIA has its own internet, its own Facebook, its own Wikipedia, and its own Google, which Google designed for them. It's provided by Google for the CIA.
It makes sense, because they would want to have a closed system, wouldn't they?
Yes. Yes, and yet they still want all those functions. I guess their Facebook is the people they work with at Facebook.
I think a lot of large corporations have their own intranet, at least. But yeah, I guess the spy folks, they just do it upright.
And he describes a time when he first worked in the CIA where he could essentially hack all these structures. And so immediately he said what everybody does when they first start working at the CIA, and the hackers can hack all these structures, is they go and find out about JFK and aliens. And he said that they really did go to the moon. He said there are no aliens that have contacted the FBI or that is on record in their files, and that climate change is real. So I thought that was kind of cool. And then he said something else.
They're all pretty important.
They're all pretty important, yeah. He had another little bit here that pertains to you and I, if I can find it. Oh, listen to my paper shuffling here.
That's not a sound effect, folks.
No, it's not. It's real life. Real life. Nope, I can't find it. Isn't that funny?
See, now you know it's not added in post-production.
Right? I would have found it. Oh, here it is. No, this pertains to us, because he talks about that all these companies wanted to make all kinds of money on the internet, and then the bubble happened and it burst because there was nothing anybody wanted to buy. Now it was the creative web that collapsed as countless beautiful, difficult, individualistic websites were shuttered. The promise of convenience led people to exchange their personal sites, which demanded constant and laborious upkeep, for a Facebook page and a Gmail account. The appearance of ownership was easy to mistake for the reality of it. Few of us understand it at the time, but none of the things that we'd go on to share would belong to us anymore. The successors to the e-commerce companies that had failed because they couldn't find anything we were invested in buying now had a new product to sell. That new product was us.
Wow, that's chilling, but it sure does ring of truth, doesn't it?
It really does have a ring of truth because you convinced me to be a blogger. I was like, I don't have anything to say. I'm never going to write anything. And I proceeded to like blog away like a maniac. And we met so many people that had amazing blogs and were so dedicated to them. And I still visit some of them. Sorry.
And some of them are still going, but a lot of those bloggers have, as he suggested, given that up and take it on the Facebook page. Yep. So the sharing is within that kind of Facebook corporate milieu.
Right. And all the colors and design and weird photos. I mean, people still obviously put weird photos on their Facebook page, but there was so much creativity. And also people would spend, you could tell, they would often spend a couple of hours a day writing their post, or at least an hour or so composing memories and reviews. And it's just not like that. If you write a long post on Facebook, everybody thinks you're a jerk. I still do.
Exactly. But, you know, I still appreciate the blogging platform, even though it's one that maybe has been diminished because of the power of Facebook.
Right.
But I like my little oasis in the cyber universe. I like to have that place where I can design it the way I want. I can put what I want on it because that's what I want. Right. And it's separate from that swamp of fake political memes and all of that kind of crap. And it's just a place that I can write, I can put pictures, whatever I feel like. And if there's going to be a small community that's going to come along with me, that's fantastic. And as it turns out, that's what there is. There's a small community.
There is a small community.
Who will look at all of my posts, and that community is quite quite dedicated and always comes back. But a lot of the views that I get on my blog these days, really, I wouldn't get if I didn't cross post over to Facebook, which is where a lot of my old blogging friends now reside.
Right,
and you know, and then they'll see the post on Facebook, and if it looks interesting to them, they might click through. And then typically if they're going to comment, those folks will comment on Facebook rather than on the blog.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may not want to activate anyone finding their old... I know a couple of people that we met through blogging that they don't want anyone to know what they did when they were blogging. Not because it was wrong or illegal or anything. They didn't want their regular friends to know it. And they are now in tune with their regular friends that are in their real life on Facebook.
Yeah, kind of interesting. True.
Yeah,
More people who blog today, I find, use blogs as a way to make income. They monetize their blogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I wouldn't have a clue how to do that.
Well, you know, I'm not against making a living.
I'm not against it either, no.
But I've never wanted to particularly monetize my blog. I like the purity of it, the fact that it's just my crap that I put up there.
Right.
And people can drop by if they want, or not. And that's all good. But I don't feel like I have to sell something in that space, you know. And again, I mean, I sell stuff. I've written the book. I sell my books.
Right.
I'm doing the graphic novel. I sell the graphic novels. Right. Happy to have people support us here on, you know, on Patreon for our podcast. But the blog space, I like that little spot in the cyber universe that that's just mine. I feel very much that way about painting as well. You know, painting's my baby, and I'm not against selling a few paintings. It's never really been the point. I've thought of painting very much as a vocation more than anything else. And as I've told people many times, I could quit anytime I want. But it turns out that it's not so easy. And, you know, at a certain point, I start to want a little taste.
Like any addiction.
That's right. Maybe I'll just do just one painting. What'll it hurt if I do one painting? Next thing you know, studio's full. I bought more paints. You know, I'm going to town. It's like, oh man, I've just backslid here. And at the same time, I've always had an uneasy relationship with the art world, which you would think would be nurturing for artists, painters, but when I was a young painter, I found that commercial galleries were interested in people who were more established. Artist-run centers were interested in people who were doing anything that wasn't painting. And and so there really, I felt there really wasn't a place. And that's one of the things that I think inspired Sheila and I to get together with you and Scott and later Stag and a number of other people and start putting on large scale group exhibitions in non-traditional spaces, you know, and we did that for a dozen years, I guess.
Right.
A number of those large exhibitions. And I think that was born out of just trying to find a place, just trying to find a place that was satisfying to exhibit.
And that wasn't corporate, that wasn't mainstream, that wasn't a shishi gallery where people were uncomfortable going into potentially. I mean, there's a number of problems with the way the art world is set up in Europe and North America. You know, it's polarized. People hate art because it's too elitist, and then the elites hate the regular artists. I mean, it's just, there's a real problem. And it's very similar to the way politics are too, polarized in terms of,
yes,
are we aesthetic creatures? We don't, people have lost a way of relating to film and art and paintings in a way of that they own it. You know, my parents read all kinds of books and had regular boring jobs and weren't elite at all. And they were interested in trendy books and what was happening, but they weren't hoity-toity. They were just, that's what you did. You read Hemingway, you read James Michener, you read Jacqueline Suzanne. They were out there and they wanted to read it and they wanted to talk about it at a cocktail party. Now you have people divided maybe the TV does that too, because, you know, you've got so many TV shows now, sometimes it's hard to find commonality. You know, how many times do you read a book and everyone you know has read it? I mean, I've got a book right here, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. I've bought 30 copies of it since it was published, and I've given it to people. I want them to read it. I want them to know about it. And it's
got mushrooms. Yes, I have a copy that you gave me.
It's got mushrooms in it. It's got a whole chapter on mushrooms. And it interviews a famous mycologist, in fact. And did I say that right, mycologist?
Yes.
Oh, good. And so, you know, you want that feeling of connection with people. People I work with, they haven't watched Breaking Bad. They haven't watched half these TV shows. They're not watching The Americans because they don't have cable. So they will watch it when it goes onto Netflix or if it goes onto Amazon. I mean, Chicago is a town that doesn't really like cable. It was the last state, did you know that, to get cable? They just thought it was the biggest ripoff on the planet to pay for TV.
we got rid of cable years ago and replaced it with a $40 HD antenna, which on a good night will get us 15 or 16 different digital TV channels. Right. Certainly all the mainstream TV we want to watch, and we watch other stuff on Netflix And we still actually use those old DVD discs.
So do I.
As opposed to just streaming.
Right, right.
Hey, on the subject of books, I wanted to tell you that I've started doing a reread of an old favorite book. And, you know, rereads for me are comfort food. They're like meatloaf with mushroom gravy. You know, I just savor them. Uh-huh. And sometimes I just feel the need to go back to an old favorite. And I'm rereading Isaac Babel, who has written two really great books of stories. One that I'm starting to reread on now is the Odessa Stories, which is a group of stories largely about the Jewish mafia in Odessa prior to the Russian Revolution.
Wow.
And about the king of all the gangsters, Benya Crick, and his adventures. It's a really fantastic book. And the other one, and sometimes they're sold as companion pieces in the same book, is the Red Cavalry Stories, which were remarkably factual stories about Babel traveled with the Red Cavalry during the Revolution, and he wrote stories about his adventures. Huh. And some of those stories later got him into trouble because he did remain factual and did use real names and didn't say the nicest things about powerful functionaries. Babel was eventually, I guess, killed by the Stalinists. I found out about Isaac Babel because I read an interview with one of my favorite painters, Philip Guston, in which he mentioned him. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't remember the exact quote, so I looked it up before we started recording. And it turns out there's various different versions of the Babel quote, because Guston brought it up. He was fairly obsessed, I suppose, with Babel and his writing.
Stay on your point. Stay on your brand.
He appreciated the fact that Babel was writing just the facts. Mm-hmm. One of the versions of the quotes I found in a book called Mutual Reflections, Jews and Blacks in American Art by Millie Haid. And the quote is, "Like Babel with his Cossacks, I feel as if I have been living with the clan, riding around empty streets, sitting in their rooms, smoking, looking at light bulbs, windows." This curious statement comes from Philip Guston, who in his intentionally bad boy paintings depicts clan characters roaming the streets as well as inhabiting the artist's studio. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I saw those late Guston paintings, they were among the paintings that sealed the deal for me when I realized I had to make paintings, that the painting could be such a powerful medium. I have to try to explore this. Those paintings they creep me out, but they fascinate me at the same time. You know, they were painted in this kind of goofy, lighthearted comic book, crazy cat sort of style. But the content was so dark, you know, it's like he was looking at the darkness of his own heart.
Right.
You know, reminds me of that that Nick Lowe song, "The Beast in Me."
Mm.
You know, it's very, very similar kind of sentiment. So when I was a young painter, I looked at Guston quite a lot. And the other single painting, really, that sealed the deal for me was when I saw Guernica when it was at the Museum of Modern Art in the Met. I'm not even sure now. But it was in New York City. Picasso had loaned it to the museum while Franco was alive, and it's since been returned to Spain.
But right, I saw it in New York City too, and I had no idea it had been returned to Spain.
It must have been at the Modern. I remember walking up a set of stairs, and you had to kind of go up the stairs and then turn around to go into the room. And of course, it's something like 38 by 11 or 12 feet. It's an enormous black and white painting. Right. And it stopped me completely in my tracks. It gave me the shivers. You know, it was just such an incredibly powerful statement. I thought, how can painting do this? Mm-hmm. Well, plus, of course, you know, we had studied Guernica in art school.
Right. And,
that means you look at it in some art history text in right. which you see this. It's always depicted as a small black and white picture. and of course, it never occurred to me that it's a black and white painting. I just thought that right. they cheaped out on the, you know, they could have added the color picture for this painting.
Right.
But they never did. And it's typically a small picture. And you walk mm-hmm. into this room and it's just so big. And Picasso was really, I think, at the peak of his powers in a way, as this incredible, soulful draftsman.
Mm.
So between mm-hmm. between old Pic and Guernica and Gustin,
right.
I became a painter. and Gustin led me to Babel, and I'm rereading the Babel story.
And how now. Is it rereading it? Are you enjoying it as much or different way?
I'm totally enjoying it.
Wow.
Both I'm savoring the memory of having read it before, which is one of the things that happens, I think, when you do a reread.
Absolutely.
But also fascinated by how much I had forgotten and how much detail I've forgotten.
Oh, that's a good feeling, too.
So I'm getting really refreshed. And as well, they're what I'll call short stories. And much like Chekhov wrote short stories. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing stories a couple years ago, and I came out with my little book of stories, the Lazy Ellen stories, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I'm developing into a graphic novel now, along with my friend Jacob Urechs.
Right.
I started to write also very, very short stories. I wanted to pare them down to the least amount of baggage that mm-hmm. you could put in a story and still have them be a story. Uh-huh. You know, and some of them barely hang on as stories. And I think, looking back, that that must have been the influence of Babel and the Red Cavalry stories in particular, some of which are just like 2 pages or 3 pages long, and are just these brief anecdotes about mm-hmm. life on the road with the cavalry.
Borsche had some pretty short stories too.
Oh yes,
and action packed,
powerful ones.
Right, crazy. Very cool. I read another. I've got another book on the go too, that I started on Audible. I listen to a lot of books on Audible in the car, and this one's called On the Clock, and it's fantastic. It's a woman who has she finished college or was between degrees and couldn't get a job in her specialty. So she went undercover with AT&T, McDonald's, and Amazon. And she worked in a huge Amazon warehouse. And the beginning of the book, she kind of talks about her methods, how she wrote about, she didn't feel bad talking about managers, but she changed the names of coworkers. She didn't want to, you know, kind of recklessly quote them. Fascinating book, a little bit like A Nickeled and Dined by Nickeled and Dime. Great book. I'll figure out the title, then the author's name later. I don't want to mess it up. But so she goes undercover, and it's so cool. It's so cool how she talks about her methods, and it's promising to be quite a good book. I'm going to finish it up and let you know more about that one too.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
Yeah, it's really good. It's very good. I just think it's so cool that she, you know, kind of wrote it. She said she didn't want to do an expose, but she definitely is doing one. And she said when she went into the Amazon warehouse, the first thing that you run into is a vending machine with pain medication. That tells you a lot, right? Right there. So, and not only that, they make you pay for it at the vending machine. You're in agony from working at the warehouse, and you have to buy your own medication on the job. So it should be pretty interesting.
Hey, speaking of vending machines,
yeah.
Do you remember the coffee machine in the old Fine Arts building at York University?
The metaphysical coffee.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
I always loved it because when you would put your money into the coffee machine, and I mean, there was no Starbucks around there. The old days at York University, I guess you could go into one of the colleges and find a better coffee. But in fine arts, there was the machine, and you put in your money and you choose like whatever kind of coffee you want. And a little light came on, a little red light, and it said brewing. As it would spew out the powder and the water into the cup.
It's probably a microwave heating up instant coffee. Let's be real. That's where your brother got it from.
That's probably why we ended up drinking a lot of tea in that building.
Yeah, it probably is. But that coffee really, the coffee was still like my secret weapon back then. I hadn't be, you know, I drank a fair bit of coffee, but it still would really work back then. Yeah, we were desperate. I also like the labels on the cup. I would love to see that again. Was it the Greek keys on it or something? There was something, even the cups were really cool.
Yeah, it was a seriously old school coffee machine. And the coffee was wonderfully bad, too.
Wonderfully bad. So kept us going. Yes?
Speaking of bad, I'm sitting on a kitchen chair right now.
Okay.
Because my usual chair that lives in front of our computer screen is starting to disintegrate. We have a broken wheel that if I move it, it gouges bits of floor out. So I went into an office supply store in an effort to buy another chair. And I'm not super fussy, right? I just want a sturdy chair that I could sit in, that could kind of roll around and could swivel. Right. It could be adjustable. Is that a lot to ask?
Yeah, I guess it is. You couldn't find one?
Well, no, I could find all kinds of them. And they ranged in price from the really flimsy ones were like $140. Mm-hmm. And then they had the super spacey gamers chairs that are like $500.
Why don't you go to IKEA? I guess
that's for people who never get up, right? You're sitting there for days on end with whatever game you're addicted to.
Does it have a little tray for your food? Why don't you go to IKEA?
Well, you know, that's a possibility. It turns out that we have a cousin who may have a chair for us, you know, an extra chair.
That's even better.
Free is better reusing.
Yes.
So hoping that does happen. But anyway, I was in this place and I was looking at chairs and I thought I would get the middle bear chair. You know, I was looking at a chair that was kind of a mid-price chair, the lower end of the mid-price chairs, but I found one that was on sale. And so I said, I'll buy this one. I had to find a guy. Because there's nobody there. Nobody wants to help you out there. And you have to go find a guy who's roaming the store somewhere. So I finally tracked down somebody who decided he was going to help me out. And he said, well, you can't buy that chair because we don't have any more. Of course, it was the only one that's on sale.
Of course.
And I said, I'll take the floor model. And this guy looked like terrified. Like, because he must have been a new employee or something. He didn't know what to do. He's like, oh my God, somebody wants the floor model. So he went to find his manager. And he comes scurrying back 5 minutes later and he says, okay, I can sell you the floor model. And I said, you know, alternatively, you could sell me this one that was similar to it that hasn't gone on sale at the sale price. I said, no, I can't do that. I'll sell you the floor model. So he wheels the floor model up to the cash and he opens a cash for me. And I think, oh, now this is what I call service. He's opening a new cash and then he's staring at the cash machine. And then he looks at me and he says, oh, there's a bit of a delay because I need an override. So he calls somebody to get the override because he doesn't have the authority to override because he's selling me the floor model and that's not a standard thing in this office supply store. So finally, the manager comes by and the manager has a little word with Buddy and then he turns to me and he says, well, there's a $20 fee I have to add on to the price because we've assembled the chair for you. And I started to laugh. I thought this is pretty funny. I said, wait a minute. This is like the demo, the floor model. You're supposed to discount it.
Right.
I'm doing you a favor by paying the sale price for this. I should probably get it for 30% less.
Right.
No. We've assembled it and we charge for assembling it.
I said to the guy,
you know, if you let leave this store without buying this chair, it's going to mean that when I need printer ink, when I need paper, when I need other office supplies, I'm going to buy them anywhere except
you. Tell him.
And he he gave me the look, which was like, oh, you damn customer. I'm not going to let the customer get the best of me. And he let me walk out of the store.
Oh, boy.
So this reminded me, if I can, and I know I'm rambling at this stage.
Oh, that's game, okay.
It reminded me of some retail history in my family, and it's a funny story. I'd like to share it.
Please do. Please do.
My grandpa used to run an enterprise called the Queen City Leatherworks in the Junction, and they made gloves for the railway men. And in fact, my grandpa invented what he called a one finger glove, which had an index finger and a thumb, and then the rest of the hand was a mitt.
Okay.
Okay, and that allowed you to have the warmth of most of the warmth of a mitten
in the
cold Canadian winters, working outdoors. But still, you had that finger free so that you could do some work activities. And it was a big seller among railway men because, of course, the Junction back then in the 20s, it was the junction of several railway lines, and it was, that was railway town. You know, the roundhouse was there.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents lived in this, or sorry, my dad growing up lived in, mm-hmm. in this building with the family, in which they had a retail storefront in which they sold the gloves and other work clothing. And then they had in the basement all the machines where they stomped out the glove shapes, and the sewing machines where they sewed everything together. And then in behind, there was a great big living room with a big living room table.
Wow.
And in my memory, they always had a collie dog who was cranky, old and cranky there at any given time. And then they had a kitchen in the back, and upstairs there were the bedrooms. So they lived and worked, much like, you know, artists have live work studios. Right. They had a live work factory retail outlet.
You're not going to believe this. Can I just
go ahead?
I just don't want to forget it. But guess what? A lot of the houses in Toronto were designed for that purpose, fashioned after houses, I believe, in Amsterdam or Europe, where the family had a cottage industry in the front room. It was not meant to be a TV room, and they're terribly small and impractical in Toronto. And then you lived in the rest of the house. Isn't that weird?
Well, I suppose it's weird, but, you know, we see it in other countries as well.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's amazing.
We visited Vietnam a couple years ago, and in Hanoi, the buildings, they're all really, really skinny buildings.
Right.
Because at one point you were taxed by how much frontage you had.
Okay.
So they made them really skinny, and then about really three funny. Or four stories tall. And the ground floor is the place where, you know, you sell your wares, or you you have your barbecue set up, and you sell your soup or whatever. And then upstairs you have the whole family who works in the in the business.
Right. So your family was doing exactly what the house was, or the building was designed to do.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
They had this retail outlet, and aside from the gloves, which they made, they had
what was the name of it again?
The Queen City Leatherworks.
Okay.
The Queen City, which I think at the time, my dad told me at least that Buffalo and Toronto were twin cities, or considered twin cities at the time, and they were known as the Queen Cities. Hmm. So Grandpa called this business the Queen City Leatherworks, but we never called it that. And in fact, I don't think I knew it was called that until I was an adult. We just called it the Glove Shop.
I love it.
And so they had this retail outlet, and they had the you could get your railroad engineers, you know, bib overalls and your engineers caps, and also they had those wonderful work socks, you know, the gray work socks with the white toes and the white heels, and then they would either have red stripes or blue stripes on the top.
I need some.
Aren't they the best? I love
those socks.
They are
the best. I love them. I'm obsessed, and I'm down to one pair.
Well, they used to get them from a guy. My dad said his name was Solly. I don't know why I remember that, because he must have told me, I don't know, 40 years ago.
Right.
They would get a job lot of these socks from Solly down in Spadina. And the deal was they would get a great price on the socks, but they couldn't choose like how many pairs of red striped socks and how many pairs of blue striped socks. You got what you got, right?
Right.
And usually it was half of each. And my dad, he helped out Grandpa in the store, and he would unload the boxes and fill up the shelves with the goods as they came in. And one day he was very upset because the box of socks that came in from Sully was almost all red striped socks and hardly any blue striped socks. And he was really concerned. And he was a young boy at the time. He was really concerned that they were going to run out of blue striped socks. So he said, "Pa, what are we going to do?" And my grandpa said, "Don't worry, son, I've got an idea. We're going to raise the price of red striped socks." And this completely confused my father, who couldn't understand how you could ever sell more of something by raising the price.
Right.
But sure enough, customers would come in and the socks would be priced, I don't know, 25 cents for a pair of the blue striped socks, 30 cents for the pair of red stripes. I'm making up those prices. It was right, the 20s. Right, right, right. I don't know. They weren't very expensive.
It was the 20s.
But it was a little bit more for the red striped socks. And people would come in and they would say to my grandpa, "Hey, Lou, what's the deal on these red striped socks? How come they're more expensive than the blue ones?" And Grandpa would say, "Oh, well, you know, the red striped socks, they're 100% pure virgin wool." And of course, they're identical to the blue ones. And he would hand a pair of each socks to the customer. And he'd say, "That's feel balls. For yourself.
That is ballsy." Right?
And, yep. And they would weigh the two pair of socks in their hands like scales. They would say, "Oh, you're right, Lou. The red striped socks, they're a heavier weight sock. They're the ones I want." And pretty soon, everyone in the junction was buying red striped socks. Nobody even wanted the blue striped socks anymore. Because everyone would rather spend a little bit more money on what they thought was better value.
Right.
Even though it was really just marketing. the next load that came in, of course, the next job lot of socks was naturally all blue striped socks, which drove my dad crazy. And he said, "Pa, what are we going to do? Now all we have is blue striped socks and nobody wants them." And Grandpa said, "Oh, that's easy, son. We're just going to raise the price of blue striped socks."
Right. I guess that's how you do it.
Yes, I think so. Oh, you know, that's a story my father probably told me a thousand times.
Yeah
he had well you knew my dad.
God,
he was
yeah.
full of oh, stories yeah.
definitely
my father, he had the technique of, like everyone in our family, we like to talk more than we like to listen. So in order to make sure no one else got a word in edgewise, my father would end his sentences with the word and.
Oh, I'm aware.
So he could segue from one idea to another.
Really,
no matter
I wonder
how disparate.
What that feels like.
It's kind of like our podcast.
Kinda. That's okay. I have my moments too. Just wait till I'm over this cold. Well, that's hilarious. That's wonderful.
Quickly.
I do want to remember something. I want to mention, we were talking about blogging, and you know, we made a lot of good friends blogging, wonderful people that have moved to Facebook, but I was reached out and talked to Drunk Punk, and he's got a show. It's on www.sfrstudios.com, and he is live between... Oh, is that my place or your place?
I'm not sure.
Oh,
Four Dinners. That was what he called himself, right? Four Dinners?
Four Dinners, yeah. He had a delightful blog. It was fantastic. I've got cars driving by on my street right now. Okay, so he's live 8 to 10 every other Wednesday, and it's called The Drunk Punk Show, so it's not for the faint of heart, and he is an amazing DJ, and I hope he does a podcast, but meanwhile, he is doing this live show every 2 weeks, so I really recommend everybody listen to it, and I think he's going to plug our podcast on his show.
Excellent. I'm certainly going to tune into his show. It's good. It's good to know that he's doing it. Big shout out to Four Dinners.
Hi, Four Dinners.
For years, one of my favorite bloggers, a really great guy.
Mm-hmm. Funny as hell. His blog was so great. He talked about his daughter, his wife, his crazy animals, and vodka. Very good stuff.
Yes, exactly. Speaking of vodka, I've just about finished my scotch.
Well, I'm just about finished my wine. Could you hear me pouring it every now and then in the background? I was topping it up. I like
so
this
I
night
guess time. We are recording late tonight as opposed to our other recordings, which we recorded earlier in the day.
And
so
it's
that's
much,
why
it's more physically comfortable for me personally, mentally and physically more comfortable for me. We
yeah,
may have to do this
bad.
Again. Yeah.
I'm not against recording late at
all
night.
All right. I feel
there is
more...
the possibility of dog snoring in the background. I don't know if that came through. But
well,
I'm sure our audience will adjust.
Right. There could be a stag snoring over here. No, he's gone to bed. He has to work early in the morning. But, it's actually nice and quiet. I don't mind that. Except for my traffic and gunshots. We had terrible gunshots the other night. So bad that apparently when Stag called his parents today, they had heard about it. Everyone ran out in the street. I don't know why people do that. I do the opposite. I lay flat
really?
In my bed or lay on the floor or something. I don't go near any windows. But, our neighbors are very curious. And Stag has a new habit. He's got some kind of app on his phone where he's listening to police calls. And I don't think he should do that. I think it's highly paranoid. But, he seems to be enjoying it. I don't
see
anything good coming out of it.
I understand. I get it when people do that. What was that movie about the guy who was listening to those police dispatches, and then he would rush to the scene of accidents and stuff and try to film them.
Was it with Bob Hoskins or something like that? I don't know. What year do you think it was?
Oh, it was just a few years ago.
Oh, no,
I
don't
completely,
know. Yeah, I can't think of it.
He was a guy, and he develops a relationship with a woman who's the news assignment editor.
Right.
And he's really, really ambitious. Gee, I wish I could remember more. I'm going to have to check that out, and we're going to put that on Facebook because I don't want to leave our audience, who are all probably listening to this, saying the name of the darn film in their
head,
because
and we're
that idiot Eugene, he starts to talk about a movie, he can't remember what it's called.
Well, it's just weird that I can't think of it right now, and I think it's one I've just missed. Did you see it in the theaters?
Oh yeah, twice.
Oh, there you go.
I think we saw it in the theater, and then I saw it also on maybe on Netflix.
I totally don't think I've seen it. Nope, over my head.
Now it's bugging me.
All right. Well,
however,
we go,
we will reprise that next week.
Totally. We've got email, and we've got, which is theagency.podcast@gmail.com. And if you want to write us a letter, we have a post office box. You can write us if you want to send a postcard or just you prefer to write. And that's where we'll be sending you swag when we have it. It's going to be The Agency, care of Anthony Stag, at post office box 891-2801, 1859, South Ashland Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60608.
And we would love to get some mail from you. And as well, keep those emails coming. We really appreciate
definitely,
it.
And definitely.
If you have anything that you'd like us to talk about, we'd love to talk about it. So
give us a job.
A note.
I like a job.
Yes, absolutely.
I like a project. Great. And I think that's probably about it. What do you think?
We're going to wrap it up for this weekend.
All right.
And we'll be back at you next week here at the agency.
Sounds good.
All right.
Great talking to you, Eugene.
Great talking to you too, Candy.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.